Wat niet eens mogen.
Say one the minute in question, I have no issue.
Thank you, Dan. I think we've also written minutes on the second page. You could go to the second last paragraph, Mr. Albert Payne, the very last line, or the, last sentence. I'll read it to you. Accumulated surplus funds in prior years were used to supplement, and I want to maybe, for more clarity, just change it to surplus income. It's to supplement surplus income, but these funds are now depleted. It doesn't really make sense if you read it otherwise. And I think in the report it's the similar change, if I could just recommend that we amend it as I've just read it.
Noted that.
Same page 2 cents under Albert A. I'm trying to leak that figure of 1.16 million. If you go to page 4, page 4, paragraph 3.1. Dispersed bullet. Saba sent the letter to the minister relevant to request for its not funding. I have talked about allocated for 9 million. I'm trying to link that for 9 million allocation and one speaks neighbor. They are not talking to each other unless I'm single. I'm not sure which figure is the speaker. What was the allocation? Was it 1 speaker? Budget or 4 million?
Yeah. Well, so I think I can see that there's 1.6 million, on the other page it says 49 million. That's the budget of the entity.
Yeah, but it's a lot of I'm not sure.
Again, say, I'm trying to again see in page 2. In page 2, the last paragraph, it is the 10 million shortfall would impact on those issues, and we also had that the digitalization of the learner records prior to 92. I take you to page 4, paragraph 3.3. SACO was in the process of digitizing all learner records prior to 1992, and they will be included in the NRR. I'm not sure the 10 million shortage impacting and them going on and doing the same thing that they don't have funds to do. Those two statements, again, I'm not talking to each other.
I think SATWA would like to digitize those records. They are lying in their offices in stacks and stacks of paper. They would like to have that put in a secure way where in the future anyone would like to access their records or would like to verify anybody's records were able to do so. I don't think they've begun doing that. In fact, they are looking for funds to be able to do that. This is one of their projects for which they are funding.
Page 4 then, 3.3. If you read that one, it is SACWA was in the process of digitizing. That means they are doing it. Are they doing it or are they not?
Doing it. If you recall the presentation of this view of also. That's got to be reformulated.
Yeah, but that's on page 4, the last sentence, the recognition of prior learning, it can be PRL.
Comments? Any comments? Wait to the minutes, colleagues?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's look at the minutes of the draft report on SATWA.
First comment that is my comment that I will make, that you don't take the report.
No, well, but the problem, the committee does not listen to the committee. I think we can't keep a comment on the same thing. If it was a sitter, I would be demanding that it must be dissolved. any further comments?
Chair, just to take note of my comment on the same, but I've already rectified it with the secretary. On the second, on that, the same page on page 2 which we have done, and I also agree to the other issues that, and then I propose that we adopt it.
Okay. Let's move to the minutes of the 30th of April.
Page 2, sir. In paragraph 3, the third bullet, starting the proposed service level agreement targets for 23 workers entering Lenasi, 1800 workers entering bursaries, or rather say receiving bursaries, not entering bursaries. Even in the following line, that was standard in bursaries. Can we change that to receiving bursaries? Can I take it to the next bullet? The next bullet, starting within terms, the last line, says for the 2013. Can we change that 2013 to 2013? Okay, page 3, 3.1, bullet 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The increase in mandatory plan was attributed to defect, not getting fixed.
I thought the Prof was going to carry on with that same sentence because there's still another zip lacking. if you read further, the fact that the Department Director seeks us to allocate the majority of discretionary grants, the majority. Maybe I've maybe missed it in the first, I didn't see there, but if you look at the draft report on page 2, let me just try and fix one or two things. On the last bullet under point 2, bank seater was the lead seater in the Free State province in terms of relationship with FET colleges, if I read it correctly, and then also in the very last page, large sentence on that page, 3.2. The committee advised that if the college is important about bank seater should also focus on lecturer capacity building and assist learners in getting employment in the banking sector. And then on the 3.3, maybe, if I'm not correct, you can point out, it emerged that the mandated grants, if it's a plural, they have more than one grant.
It must be just a grant.
mandatory
there is,
zone.
There are two types of grants, that is the mandatory and the discretionary one.
Okay.
But then
there must be a mandatory grant in front of it.
Sir, I think let's thank the commissioner because it's related that this has been to Israel. On this paragraph 2, it will be same changes as in the minutes. I take you to paragraph 3. Paragraph, very first line, page, paragraph 2.3. It means that mandatory grant of the 2013-14 financial year increased by 137%. And the committee was concerned that training and development of workers would be affected. Why is an F positive if it is affecting training negative? When you have 137% increase, that leads to a concern that you can't train. It's just there's something. And if you go to the minute itself, you can't find that 137% affected anywhere.
Was it the increase or the decrease?
I think the concern was raised because this is in terms of the new CETA grants, they've shifted funds from the discretionary grant to from the mandatory grant to the discretionary grant. So it was raised because members were concerned that it will affect the training of the employees. So if they're moving more funds from the money that is meant for the employees, training of the employees, to the unemployed for the bursary, for the pivotal grant.
I'm not sure if it is us who would have been concerned. We agree that more money must go to career direct programs which are found in colleges and in universities, and that employers were giving workers bogus training programs just for the purpose of gaining money. I think we may have to check what was our perspective on this one.
And say, even if that was the case, it should be reflected as such. Because it is reflected as if the increase is bad, not the transfer from one to the other. Can I take you to the part of 3.9? It means that 1.3 million was improperly allocated to Bank Street, and Treasury had informed Bank Street that those funds would be reversed. Bank Street requested the committee to assist in this matter, as this matter by Treasury would negatively affect the implementation of skill development programs. I'm not sure what is expected of a committee when wrong funds are transferred to and they have to be reversed. I'm not saying that even is wrong, but to me, I don't know. It affects something across us.
I think the view that expressed was that the bank should, if it has got any programs which are unfunded, it should be able to approach the National Skills Fund. Yes, that's what we said. And that if it is necessary for us to acquire it, to be how we came about that more money could be given to them and only to the recoup the later stage on the basis that it was not meant for them. We will instruct Treasury to give money that are not due to the CETA, but if they had problems and had funding, they would approach NSF and will express our view in support thereof if they have approached us in that regard.
The situation actually requested the committee to assist.
If I remember what he said, I think we where the other side, I don't know, there is a, if you can one check the answer, what I'm saying is there. We did not necessarily say, well, go to uphold treasury. I summarized clearly in response to what Mr. Mahosi said, that they may have a shortfall in terms of some of the problems. And you had said that they could approach the National Rescue Fund in that regard, and that will or support them in the event they do present a comprehensive program in that regard. HANSAT may help. In fact, if it may be advisable, if maybe you write me to request HANSAT, well, I think they can print out these things. Then you are able to verbatim know what Martin said. I can still recall, even though now I have not read HANSAT this morning. Any further comments? Let's proceed to the last niece of the tale of life.
So,
for record purposes, because we don't just speak without ensuring that the system records what we say. It's seconded.
Yes.
I just see while standing by your honorable children.
Yes, no, thanks. Moni has done so even by nodding, so it has been in many ways. So thank you, but the Lord, the shape of the head may not be captured with the camera, not yes.
Okay, Chair, I formally second the minutes.
Thank you very much. Our meeting with the delegation from Azerbaijan.
Could I suggest that my apologies for the fact that this is as well as I believe without apologies?
Yes, yes. I think in the last note that Prof did apologize. I think
my apology chair should also be recorded.
Okay. Yeah, no. So this will be noted.
My attention to the president was also to record my apology.
We'll record the apologies, and I hope these minutes are not meant for the House.
Yeah.
Yes, these minutes are not meant for the House. It was just a courtesy visit to Parliament that we really also responded to that by giving them an opportunity to plan about our Parliament. Mm-hmm.
What needed to happen was your statement in passing to indicate that we had that intention for members to help the check out all my
other. Let's therefore just say the members will interact with the record just to understand the sort of interaction that we've had with the delegation from that institution in Azerbaijan. Okay, no, thanks very much.
For the record as well, for the correctness, we've also apologized for Professor Lertfried on now, so it's also not on the agenda.
Yes, no, we'll note that accordingly.
Okay.
Thanks very much. We are going to proceed to the presentation by the and there are time for the answer and hard case. No, we want the QCTO first. We are chairing now, and then we are chairing the meeting. My writing minutes.
offers.
Morning, Chair, Honourable Members. By way of introduction, my name is Siri Madilonga. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at the CTO, and I'm accompanied by Mr. Thomas Lata, who's the Chief Director, Quality Qualifications Management, and would like to firstly apologize on behalf of our chair, who currently booked at the hospital during a health-related procedure, and our CEO currently out of the country, scheduled to return tomorrow, and it was not envisaged that this date, would be expected to appear before the committee. So we are here mandated and representing them and on their behalf. So in this presentation, we'll interchange myself and Mr. Lata in presenting before the committee. In that regard, I'd like to hand over to Mr. Lata to do the first part of the presentation, and then I'll
Thank you. So let me just interject there immediately. I think under did inform my office that your CEO is abroad and that the chairperson of the board is having health reasons that would cause him not to be here. And I was not in a position at that stage to make a conclusion on behalf of the committee. I had to permit you to come here because this meeting was scheduled. And if I had stopped you then and the members arrived here, I'm sure they would have really expressed concern with me that I could just unanimously, without informing them in due course, postpone this meeting. It was my view that maybe we should not proceed with the presentation on the basis of the absence of key people in your institution, so that you are able to come strengthened by the board and also senior management, as I know that also part thereof. I don't know whether members would like to say anything to that, so that we could request them to come after later date.
Thank you very much from your side, Chair, for clarifying that, because I think that was going to be my first question, as to say, why are you here if their leaders are not here? it is a concern. We know as a federal committee, those are the people that are accountable, those are the people that need to interact with us, which might be the extension of the mental staff, but really the people are accountable is the person is you. It's those who are not here, and it raises a lot of concern. But Chairperson, I know excuse me, the documents have been vacated since last week. They've all gone through their presentation. I think all of us as members of the portfolio committee preparing for this meeting. Chairperson, before, I don't know really whether we'll continue or not, but before they are even given a chance to do that, I'd love also to express my dissatisfaction about the presentation that is has been prepared, if I still this one that we have been given as members of the portfolio committee. As to the Chairperson, I believe we're expecting their APP. There are things that are standard that we need to look at to see when we talk of it. We need to see your target. You know, it should be. We need to see what is it that you are doing, you want to achieve by when your target and whatever. But Chairperson, as I'm saying, before they even present, for me, what they have submitted, I don't believe it's what the committee needed. Unless I'm proven otherwise, unless when they begin even to talk about it, I don't know whether to present or not. But I'm just opening it up as to say, I wonder if us as members of this portfolio committee, we have gone through it, but it was a little bit disappointing even to go through this and expect that this is the APP that is going to present it to Parliament. It did not paint a good picture of the QCTO coming to us with this presentation. And I just wanted to register the disappointment that I got when I went through this. Thank you.
Chairperson, I also share the same view in terms of the worry and the concern that we have officials here and that we don't have the people who are accountable. My other worry is that cost has been incurred in coming here, but then also in relation to what Honourable Gina has said, I also have my concerns about the presentation. I don't know whether we'll be able to then ask the questions that we really want to ask.
As well as with a great deal of reluctance on my part to release a structure without them having to give a presentation, in my strongest view, I always enjoy engaging with whomever appears before me, believing that they have the necessary capacity and mandate to be able to traverse the presentation as required. I am going to release the delegation from the QCTO and request that maybe they must interact with the department on the standard format of the APP. Normally you'll have a standard format where you populate your APP with targets, with the budget and everything else, and then it's your presentation separately. So in my view, you could have your presentation that sets out the targets or budget and everything else, but still you've got to have that standardized format of an APP. So you had the taste of the pudding, that what we need is this and that, so we'll have an opportunity to go and your presentation. I must apologize for you to have had to come here. You could have been doing other things at work. I'm sure the committee will not be hard on you for having spent money coming here. We are debating after in the house. You can join us.
Before they release the chair, there's no lament for such an understanding why they formulated it, what accounts for this, was it somewhat not knowing what we needed, or what is, I think they couldn't share with the committee what led to
being put on the spotlight by the committee.
Honourable members and Chairperson, we do acknowledge that presentation is not in a format that the committee would have expected. We will certainly relay the message to the Chairperson and the CEO, since they are the ones that prepared the presentation, and as you already mentioned, this presentation was circulated earlier. And
definitely lies with the department to be able to see what is the correct format. And it is my hope that when the delegation appear, the date that would have been given by the committee, the PCTO would have prepared a presentation that's much more relevant and suitable and to standard that is expected by the committee. We, on behalf of the CEO and the chairperson, we really want to humbly submit our apology to the committee, and we will definitely communicate that to our FIFA.
Yes, I'm just aware that there is also a number of boards actually. There will be a presentation later on who could as well be allowed the opportunity to do so.
Thank you, Chair. I'm in a difficult situation because I'm coming to present on behalf of the CAC, and I don't want the committee to think that we collude between the different councils because we sit on each other's boards, the councils. I'm not sure in the case of the QCTO whether currently it's not to defend the presentation. I don't think it's so much an issue where the QCTO is not familiar with the format of the performance indicators, the targets and so forth. But the QCTO is going through a difficult transitional period in terms of determining and defining its role and all its activities. And at the board is rethinking, as you know, the minister has released the qualifications framework and the issues that is asked for further clarification and so forth. So I think that in the context, I don't want to speak for the board and the CEO and the chair, so I'm not sure that even when they come back, they're necessarily going to have the kind of detail that the other councils normally present. So I just want to put that context. It's not to, I think they should try to put as much detail as possible, but you're not going to, in my view, given the current thinking about where the QCTO should be, what kind of qualifications it should offer, and so forth. That kind of detail that the other councils are able to provide, because we've been established and running for a long period of time. So there are some challenges that the QCTO would have to come and address and explain to the board in terms of how it presents its thing. I just wanted to present that as a context, not the SOA.
Chair, what we are appreciating that, to me, even if they are going to come back with something that which is not what we are expecting, they should not pretend that it is. Without any background to say we are giving this because we have this problem and this problem, so we have an understanding. Once you throw in something like this, our assumption is that you thought that was it. And that throwing that therefore, if they are going to bring something tomorrow, whatever it is, and there are some issues that are tying them down, they must put it in the background that this is where we are and we cannot do ABC, therefore.
And Chairperson, I think then this meeting, though we did not get what we wanted, it has opened doors because we have QCTO, we have a member of the board, we have got the department. Those challenges the member of the board is raising today, I think they need to get a platform where they can be discussed and, you know, and clarified if ever there are anything that thing that needs to be done. And also, I always think, Chairperson, always emphasize the open door policy that we have as a committee to say, with those challenges, we are open enough to listen to them and see if ever there are any instances where we can assist. So I think maybe it was a good thing that such a thing happened, then in future we are going to be together in trying to solve such problems. Thanks.
I hope that the interaction we want to have will be a good platform to look at all the challenges that are there. The trajectory in which the fund itself would clearly be internalized by us as we engage with them. I think I should take that as the last moment of the okay. Yes.
Honorable Chair, just in closing, there are ongoing discussions taking place between the department and QCTO. This has happened with the minister already, and it's going to happen with the DG the following week. There is a scheduled meeting on the 28th of May, wherein a way forward will be paved. So it is our hope that the presentation that will be presented at a later stage to the committee will be much more informed than currently is. Thank you.
it should not be a matter of suggesting you come next week. You must allow an opportunity to interact with the department and conclude your engagement and then have an opportunity to have a better chance.
Absolutely.
Okay. No, thank you. I think Annette will entertain those observations. Thank you very much, Charles. Then we can just 5 minutes break, allow the council application to do.
Yeah,
thank you.
How many people are from the Zoom? Thousands, 3,000 people after the met een moeilijke lancering, dat kan niet voor je binnen. Het is echt een probleem. In spijt van je witte. Die verstand rechtig waar het gaan is. Die vergelijken alle hier zo binnen dat in Europa tussen die standpunt is al niet de balans is. Tussen arbeidsproductiviteit en het kapitaal wat gegenereerd wordt daar weer. Dus je moet niet in balans brengen. Toen wijs je product dat is die gebalikation op al die mijne zeggen, dat het geluid is, hoeveel procent doorgaan invasie. Die landbouw 50% doorgaan invasie, waar hulle met 100% doorgaan verhoging begin heet. So ek meen, dit is net nie een verband nie, dit is net nie een verband nie. Ja, nee, maar dit is goed. Dit is die grootste die moeilijkheid. Ek meen, dit moet onafhankelijk wees. Dit ek al gesê, dit moet onafhankelijk wees. Kan nie in die regering sit in matte in die grote arbeidsmarkt wat boter is. Maar gelukkig ken ek die arbeid en dit is nie. Dit is een van my akkakke wat ek gehanteer het in by landbouw. Ek het eindelijk in periode dat ek jou landbouw arbeidswetgeving het echt onderhandel met koesaties. Ek nog die landbouwwetgeving om te teken op die einde van die dag so ons het te doen. Die finale gebeurt en so kom ek hier 3 uur in die nacht. Voordat die volgende dag moet in die parlement gebeur. Van die minister, want die heer is wat hulle gaat beleid. Je kan nie die macht van een individuele universiteit ontwanden. Hier en half uur dit. Ek neem die universiteit. Wat is sy eie karakter, sy eie staat, sy eie prioriteit wille en sy internationale aanvaardbaarheid.
En ook
maak nie saak. Dat wil hulle als beheer, voor als beheer. En in het groot kritiek op spil, wat my vies maak, is die vreselijke kritiek oor die transformatie wat hulle in die Amerikaanse universiteit. Ja, nee. Nee, het is zeker. En ik denk, wat heeft dat verkeerd gedaan? Dan wist dat ik een keer zwart van tussen.
En ik bedoel, is ja, nee. Ik heb geen paar jongen met hem.
Nee, dat is niet om die Amerikaanse universiteit in de maat te komen. Maar je ziet hoe groot het is, die Amerikaanse universiteit, dat is hier die beste, die internationale erkenning, dat beter uit standaarden. Kan het niet vallen.
Before we continue, I think I'm taking this opportunity on behalf of the Portfolio Committee to congratulate Honorable Makubele, and our whip beginner for graduating for the Advanced Governance and Public Leadership certificate offered by Bates University. I think we were part of the 32 members of parliament that successfully completed this program. It is a great inspiration to all of us and also underscores our commitment to lifelong learning. Congratulations. Let me take this opportunity and allow the Councillor Hakeshin to give their presentation.
Thank you, Chair. I was going to say I'm going to have to go back and check whether those programs have been properly
attended.
Thank you, Chair. If I can start by just introducing the, thank you for the opportunity, the delegation. On my left is Ms. Bruce Shongwe, who's our Chief Financial Officer. And to her left is Professor Beverly Thaver, who is the Deputy Dean of Education at the University of the Western Cape and a member of Council. We currently we don't currently formally have a chair in terms of a chair appointed by the Minister. The chair term came to an end at the end of last year. There is a process, the Minister advertised in the media and so forth, so there is a process for the appointment of the chair. We have, in the meantime, in the EXO appointed the acting chair, Professor Mota. Our difficulty for this meeting has been that two of our EXO members are both medical doctors, Professor Mota and Dr. Musuku. And because the meeting, this is the third day we've now, because for a variety of reasons about the vote and so forth, the scheduled meetings were changed. And they have to get advance notice if they're going to be away from hospitals and so forth. So they were not one of them was not able to come. I'm sure the department can, if there's need about where the process is for the appointment of the department, will be able to currently. In terms of presentation, Chair, you have received, I think, both the PowerPoint presentation, which I suppose is less important, but also the APP. Unfortunately, with the performance indicators at the end. So I'm going to take you through and then hopefully whatever questions and issues the committee would like to raise, we can engage in appropriately. The presentation, usually, just to remind ourselves that I'm not going to spend any time on it, what the functions of the CHC are, is to advise the Minister quality assurance, which includes institutional audits, the program accreditation process that we just talked about, the qualifications framework, which is a new function in relation of the National Qualifications Act, and more generally, publishing information on developments and so forth in higher education, the monitoring function. We included in our presentation the strategic imperatives that we identify in the APP that flow from these functions. And we partly done it, it was in the 5-year strategic plan, but there was some overlap. We had 5 imperatives that we revised them because there was overlap and so forth, and we created 4 to better inform the APP as we did other bits. So the first is to contribute to informing policy and influencing the public debate on policy in higher education. Secondly, to contributing to developing the role of quality assurance in conjunction with the tools that the department uses. The department uses planning and funding to steer the higher education system. And in terms of the policy framework, quality assurance is a third tool. And as we've talked about before, there are challenges in whether all the tools have been used in an integrated fashion. Thirdly, is to ensure that the qualifications framework, and it should be the higher education qualification sub-framework. As you know, the minister has gazetted all frameworks. They are now called sub-frameworks as part of the NQF. And finally, to grow the organization and sustainability of the CG as an organization. Now, from these imperatives, we then identify a range of strategic goals and objectives which are outlined in the APP. In relation to the first goal, which is around the analysis and monitoring of higher education and the advice to the minister, we have 2 objectives. The one is the advice objective. The advice objective has 2 forms. One is to advise the minister at his request on matters relating to higher education. And secondly, to advise the minister when the council itself thinks there are issues on which it would like to address the minister. We have previously, in the last year, and I'm raising this because we didn't come present our annual, last year our annual plan presentation was cancelled. In the last year, we were not asked for any advice directly by the minister. In the previous years, there were 4 or 5 pieces of advice that we had given the minister. We have, however, from the council side, given the minister advice in March of the last financial year, March of this year, on the role of public higher education colleges, so public colleges, particularly the issue of agricultural colleges and nursing colleges. And we did so in the context we did last year. We were asked by the Department of Agriculture and Fisheries to do a reaccreditation of the agricultural colleges, at least the higher education programs that the agricultural colleges offer. And the outcome of that process was that a lot of the challenges that were identified that agricultural colleges face were linked to the fact that their status and location had not been clarified. It's an old issue from post-1994 about where those colleges should be located, whether they should come under the Department of Higher Education and Training, whether they should remain where they currently are under the land ministries to which they report. And more importantly, they also currently tend to, within the land ministries that they are, there tend to be a tension between the fact that they are run by the provinces, while they are national responsibility insofar as they offer higher education qualifications. So those are issues that need to be resolved. And so we've given the minister advice that matter. We haven't specified the particular way in which the options that need to be used because it's complicated, particularly in nursing colleges. But we've indicated to the minister, in line with the issues raised in the Green Paper about post-school education, that matter needs to be resolved. It's an ongoing problem for the last 14 or 15 years, and for a range of reasons not been possible to resolve, that we need to move forward on that. As you also know, we had a project on looking at the introduction, whether the current degree and diploma structure, undergraduate diploma and degree structure, is appropriate for the context in which the students that come into higher education. As you know, if you've looked at the vital steps, I think we distributed copies to members of the committee, and it was in the media more recently. Currently, about 50% of young people who enter higher education drop out without graduating. And it's a problem, and I'm excluding UNISA, distance education programs. And commonly, we understand the problem that it's a problem of young people who come from either poor school backgrounds, rural backgrounds, and so forth. But the analysis of the data suggests it's a much bigger problem, because only 30% of students, of all students, including those students who come from well-prepared schools. So what we normally would assume is that Indian and white students who enter higher education because of their school backgrounds should be adequately prepared and able to complete their degrees if they're doing a three-year degree in 3 years or a four-year undergraduate degree in 4 years. Only 30% of those students complete in regular time. So it's a much bigger problem than is commonly assumed about poor quality of schooling. It suggests that there may be a bigger gap between school and higher education than poor quality of schooling. So there has been a task here that the CIP had called last year. It's completed its work. It's currently, the report that will be released is being edited, going through a final edit. What the council has agreed to do is it will release the report as the report of the task team and call for comment from the higher education sector and the public. And after it assesses the comments that have come through, it will then provide the minister with advice on whether introducing or restructuring the structure of the undergraduate qualification to a four-year qualification is appropriate or not. So that's a fairly major project and would be a fairly major intervention in a policy sense. Secondly, as you know, we've received Bible sets, the first version of Bible sets. We're in the process of updating it and releasing it, the second version, which should be due in the next 2 months or so. And we'll continue now doing that on an ongoing basis, including bringing out smaller ones that could then do more detailed analysis of the data. The one we sent you essentially provide the data without any comment on the data. So all of this is part of, as you know, previously we've indicated that one of the big weaknesses we had is that our monitoring and evaluation function was weak. We didn't have the staff and the capacity internally to manage that. And since October last year, we now have a fully functioning monitoring and evaluation directorate. So part of this work and the work that I'm going to present now on the projects we've identified and which the council has approved, it's a long list. Not all of these projects, because this directorate only took off in October last year, not all of the projects necessarily will happen in this financial year, but we want to give you an indication of the projects that we plan. The big one is the review of the state of higher education, which is a 20-year review. It's presented there as a 10-year review. The CIT had previously done a review, a 10-year review from 1994 to 2004. What we're planning to do now is a 20-year review, which would essentially say what were the, starting in 1994, what were the policies that were adopted and the plans that were put in place to address whatever the challenges were in higher education. Which of those challenges have been addressed in the intervening period since 1994, and there are many things that have been addressed. And what are the continuing challenges, either from the past that remain, or what is the new context in which higher education, what are the new developments regionally, internationally, that may impact on higher education that we need to take into account. The most obvious one, although my own view is that it's often exaggerated, is the issue of what are called the MOOCs. You know, many of the big institutions in the world are now putting their courses online. I forget what it stands for. It's MOOCs and something called Coursera. And you can do any number of courses that are offered by big institutions who have all put their courses online. They don't offer them currently as qualifications. So people do them out of interest. So if you're interested in ancient African history, there may well be a course, for instance, on that, on the internet, offered by a sort of big name professor in some in places like Oxford and Cambridge and Harvard and so forth. So it's taken on in a major fashion. It may well have implications if those institutions eventually start offering those courses online for qualification purposes. Okay. Whether they do that or not remains an open question, but it's something we need to start to think about. What's the likely implication of technological developments that impact on higher education? So the review will cover 20 years. And the way we're doing the review is we put out a call for submissions, which you may have seen in the media, where we were asking people who are doing research in higher education whether they had a particular work that they were doing that would contribute to the review, and if they were interested in participating and submitting their papers. We also, for the themes that we're going to focus on, establish little groups of academic researchers who work in the field in order to be engaged with them about what the key issues, what the challenges are, what the research is showing. So it's a fairly major project which we hope will be completed towards the end of next year in terms of the council bringing out a document about its views on what the state of our education is. Some of what is listed under the research will feed into that review. So we have a project currently on looking at institutional governance and management. We've looked at three institutions, the University of Zululand, the University of the Val University of Technology, and the China University of Technology, all of which in the recent past have had administrators. We've done background work, we've interviewed the assessors, we've interviewed people in the institutions. So we've got the basic background information. We're now going to broaden it out to look at some of the other institutions, like Walter Sisulu and so forth, in order particularly to address the issue of whether current tools, the role of the assessor, the role of the administrator, what are the challenges of those tools, particularly given that in any of these institutions, if you take Walter Sisulu, we've now had the third administrator, or the fourth in the last 10 or 15 years. VUT has had its second or third administrator, so it's an ongoing issue, and the fact that we appoint administrators doesn't seem to address the problem in the long term, because the problems re-emerge in different forms. So it's really to make an assessment of what goes on in those institutions and what kinds of other tools may be required if we want to stabilize governance and management. The issue of student governance, we're again doing some background research on. We are particularly concerned or interested in the issues of multi-campus SRCs, where it's more than in institutions where there's more than one campus, because it's often been the source of conflict within the institution. There are also issues about whether student political organizations should be allowed to participate in SRC elections and so forth. As you know, in some cases institutions have gone an all different route. There may well be constitutional implications about in terms of the right to free association and so forth, whether you can stop a student political organization from participating in an election. So looking at the whole issue of student government in that context. The state of private provision, there's not enough known, there's not enough information. I'll come back to that because we've got a project with the department on creating a new information system for private higher education. We're also looking at asking, this is in the early stages of planning, you know, as you know, one of the big problems in all our institutions is the issue of leadership and management, particularly having stable management and leadership. We've now got a reasonably large number of retired senior leaders and administrators from higher education, and we'd like to ask them to reflect on what is it that makes for good leadership and management in higher education, and to bring out a book on that in order to help people who are moving into those positions reflect on what they need to do as they move into these positions. The national benchmark tests are put in. We have a joint project with Umalusi. Umalusi is looking currently at the relationship between the national senior certificate and how people perform in the first year at higher education. And we've been discussing with them the possibility of making an assessment of whether what role the national benchmark tests play in facilitating the predictability or the potential of students to perform and how they perform in higher education. And the last two are really more longer term things, changing trends in postgraduate education and the changing nature of the academic profession. The academic profession, at least, if any of you, for those of members of who've been academics, so there are people here who've been in that, has been changing. For instance, in the past, academics used to get academic tenure, which meant essentially black judges, they were in their post for life. Unless they did say something that deserved for them to be fired without any recourse. The nature of that is changing. Increasingly, institutions are employing people on a part-time basis, short-term basis, and so forth, which may well impact on the academic project within an institution. So if you don't have people with reasonable security of employment and so forth, whether they stay in place, the kind of way we define it. So we want to look at that as a longer-term research project. But as I said, some of this, the issues of governance, student governance, private higher ed, while we're doing discrete background work, will next to feed into that broader review of higher education because it fits into the themes. And as part of the review, we also want to look at the minister has got there's been work on the funding formula, so we want to look at whether the formula as it was, what are the challenges of that formula. We're not going to duplicate the work that the funding review group has done. And to look at the planning tool, whether the planning tool that we have, the enrollment planning process and so forth, because those are the key policy tools that we've had, what the impact has been and what are we to be reviewed going forward. So that's broadly in relation to the whole area of monitoring and advice and so forth. In terms of the second goal, which is around the issue of qualification standards, qualifications and so forth, as you know, as I indicated, the minister approved the qualification framework. We have a new higher education qualification sub-framework. There were no major changes. The minister made two changes only, which were really wording changes. The one is no longer referred to as the higher education qualification. It's not called the sub-framework. And secondly, the minister raised, as you know, in the new sub-framework, we now make provision for professional masters and professional doctorates. And in the framework, we refer to professional and we refer to academic or general masters and doctorates. And I think the minister was pointing out quite rightly that general masters and doctorates are traditionally academic qualifications, and one didn't want to use the term general to describe them. The new qualifications that have now been introduced, and institutions are currently planning the introduction of those, are the two-year diplomas which are linked to professional qualifications, particularly in the health sciences. We have completed the alignment of what were the Category A programs in the qualifications framework. Category A programs were programs that were really required technical changes, either the way the number of units that they described had to change and so forth. As we've indicated before, there were some 20,000 programs in public higher education institutions. I don't have the latest figure, but the alignment process has allowed most institutions to review whether they needed all of the programs they had on their books. In many cases, they had programs on their books which they had for the last 20, 30 years, which they weren't actually necessarily teaching. So it has allowed the institutions to clean up their program profile and the qualifications they have on their books now. We now, this year, are going to be starting to do the Category B programs. The Category B are the ones where, in terms of the qualifications framework, has changed, that changes, substantive changes that need to be made, but which are less than 50%. So it doesn't require completely a new program to be developed. And we have a process with institutions currently underway to do that. And then in terms of when the minister gazetted the approval of the sub-frameworks, he indicated a range of areas, recognition of prior learning, credit accumulation and transfer, and articulation, which he had asked SACWA to advise him on. So SACWA is currently going through a process of developing frameworks for all of these areas. We participate in those processes, SACWA processes. And once the SACWA process is complete, we will then look at what the implications of whatever SACWA has adopted as a policy framework, what the implications would be in our case for higher education, and we would then have to develop the appropriate policies for the HEQSF in that regard. In terms of the standard setting mandate or standard development mandate, the Council in December approved a framework for standard development, and we are now this year going to start piloting. We're looking initially at piloting subject to final agreement in social work, possibly in the LLB. We're meeting with a gentleman LLB conference next week, and some of the professional qualifications. And then we're planning the whole conference towards the latter part of the year to look at the whole issue of standards development. In terms, as I indicated before, in terms of private higher education, the only information that we collect at the moment is information that we submit to SAQUA in terms of what's known as the National Learner Reports Database. So it's information about individual students and what they achieved. What we don't have in for private higher education is a similar information system as we have for the publics, which is managed by the department, which is the Higher Education Management Information System. And we have had a joint project with the department and SAQUA, as well as with the private associations that represent private institutions, about developing an information system that will capture for privates the kind of information that we capture for public higher education institutions. So that would both provide more detailed information about what goes on in private higher education, but also allow from a research point of view comparisons to be made between public and private higher education. That project is fairly close to finalization. We're looking at the final technical specifications and then discussing with the department how we take it forward and whether this is a project that eventually the whole system, once it's developed, should be sitting in the department like the one with the publics. We've been on doing that because it means the department will fund it and will have to continue funding it if it's in the department, and we won't have to worry about funding. But that's an ongoing conversation we're having with the department at the moment. In terms of moving to a quality assurance framework, there's ongoing work around the existing institutional audit process, which came to an end last year, or in 2011. We previously indicated the council, both the HEPC and the council, were rethinking what do we do now that we've completed one cycle of audits. Do we continue doing something similar, or do we do something to have a greater impact in terms of the higher education system? And what the council has approved in December is what we're calling a framework of quality enhancement, which is really going to focus on, in the light of the current group problems that we have with large numbers of young people not graduating after 5 or 6 years, what is it that we need to do? What have we learned? What have institutions learned? And what are the challenges and what are the possible interventions in order to enhance student success? The same finding common solutions by working together, because the way we see this happening is, unlike the audit process, we want to bring institutions together. So, for argument's sake, in the Western Cape, to bring the four institutions in the Western Cape to focus on a particular issue around student success, whether it's classroom teaching or technology, and for the institutions to jointly engage and discuss about what they've done, what's worked, and to identify what interventions are necessary. There may be interventions that are policy interventions, in which case one can advise the minister that in order to better do this, there's need a new policy. There will be issues for institutions, sort of best practices, but really is to focus all of them on a sort of common national project to jointly work together about how do we improve student success in higher education. As I indicated, the council has approved this. We are currently we've been engaging with the institutions, particularly with the Deputy Vice Chancellor, who is responsible for teaching and learning for academic affairs, about how we flesh out details of the project. And currently, as we speak, are having focus group consultations with a number of institutions and institutions in a number of regions. Because for this project to succeed, it requires the institutions to work together. One of the big issues is institutions often don't like to work together, you know, because it's seen as they're in competition with each other. And what we're saying to institutions, this is not about competition. This is about, we have a national challenge about how do we better improve teaching and learning or student success. And we need to share best practices and so forth. So what we anticipate is that the focus group consultations will be completed around June, July, and then we'll develop a more detailed plan for how we take it forward. We are planning three regional seminars in September, where we're bringing a fairly noted international academic on student success to kickstart the project. And maybe when we, if the members are interested, when we have those seminars in September, the dates haven't been finalized, we can inform you if you would like, if members would like to attend. There'll be a seminar in Cape Town, one in Durban, one either in Pretoria or Johannesburg. In terms of accreditation, aside from going to check whether the programs that the members have done have been properly accredited, we continue with the ongoing work. As you can see, as we've indicated before, we're getting large numbers of new programs. It continues. The reaccreditation refers to the private programs where the registration of an institution, private providers are given a 5-year registration by the department. At the end of the 5 years, they need to be re-registered, and as part of the re-registration, their programs have to be reaccredited. Our current focus, aside from our normal accreditation work, we anticipate that in the course of this year and starting next year, institutions, as you know, the minister has last year on 2011 promulgated new norms and standards or a new framework for teacher education qualifications, and institutions are going to have to revise their programs, which will have to be submitted for accreditation. We anticipate, they're busy doing so at the moment, so we anticipate in the course of this year and early next year we'll be started with programs, with requests for those programs. We've also been talking, engaging with the department on how to accredit the programs of the two new planned institutions, which are planned to start next year. Because the normal program process, accreditation process, takes anything from, everything is in place between 3 to 6 months. It goes through various evaluations and committees and so forth. In this case, it may be difficult if we were to stick to our normal process to ensure that those programs are accredited in time to be offered in 2014. So we have a process, and we're working with the, I think it's the project steering committee of the two new institutions and the universities. We anticipate currently that there are going to be 4 programs that are being submitted for approval. And so we're looking at how we fast-track the approval of those programs in the course of this year so that they're ready to be offered in 2014. We also have just started the review, the national review of the social work qualification. It's similar to what happened previously in the past with the MBA, where the focus is on the qualification and the program. And can lead to a de-accreditation of a program. It's one way. A lot of our accreditation processes are compliance processes because of the number of programs we receive. So this is a much more focused look at the program by sending a panel of peers to each institution that offers the program. The peers agree on what the minimum requirements for such a program are, and then assess whether the institution is meeting that minimum. And if it's not, well, there are 2 things. One can either say you need to improve and give them time to improve. In some cases, in the case of the MBA, for those members who would recall, it was a big issue at the time, a number of programs would be accredited because they didn't meet the minimum standard. So we just started with a social work process currently, and we are also engaging with the deans of law about looking at the 4-year LLB for a range of reasons. And as I said, we are meeting with ongoing consultations with them, and we are meeting them next week again. If the law thing happens, it will happen, it will start sort of late in 2014, because it's a fairly intensive process. Social work will be completed around mid next year. In terms of quality promotion, we continue on an annual basis to, together with the Higher Education Teaching and Learning Association, offer Teaching Excellence Award. There are 5 awards offered. For people in different categories. We've been having meetings with quality managers, both the public, private, and in the statutory professional bodies. We have 2 meetings a year to discuss common issues and problems, and we continue training people who participate in our processes for auditing, program evaluation, and so forth. finally say before I hand over to the CFO to just take us through the budget, we have, I think I can say with some confidence now that the challenges we've identified in the last 2 years, these were challenges both organizationally and administratively. As you know, we had in 2010-11 some 50 audit findings about issues and processes and so forth. I think all of those have been addressed. I'm pleased to say we also, in terms of, we've got the monitoring and evaluating directive up and running. Our capacity has improved. Our finance section, for a long time we didn't have a CFO. Usi joined us in September last year. We now have a fairly stable finance section. So I think we're reasonably well placed now. We've turned the corner. We're not quite out of it. There are some issues, particularly organizational issues that we are still addressing. But we think we're in a reasonably good space in terms of being able to do the kind of work that we've identified. If I can then ask Lucy to take us through the budget income and expenditure.
Okay, thank you, Chair. With regards to the budget, the income, we receive most of our income from the DAGT, and then we have the deferred income that relates to the 9 million that the department gave to the CHE for the establishment of the standard development. What the budget is saying, they will, for the current year, we will be spending 2.1 million of the budget, and 2014 will be using the 2.1 million of the deferred income. For 2015-16, we do not have any money there because we anticipate that the 9 million will be fully paid. So because of that, for us to be able to continue with the standard development work, we will probably require additional funding from the department so that we can continue with the standard development. With regards to the expenditure, we've budgeted for goods and services current year is the 90.8 million and for personnel cost is 25. And the personnel cost, it was just an increase of about 6% that was allowed by the National Treasury. But I'd like to bring to the attention of the committee that we had a budget reduction for the current year, I think, of 1%, and this was a requirement of the National Treasury. Currently, for the current year, we don't anticipate any problem because we think we'll be able to use the surplus funds that we had in the previous year, subject to the approval from the National Treasury for the rollover. According to our project, of what we have projected, the expenditure is 46 million. But when you look at all the projects that we have planned to do in the current year, we need about 54 million. So we will be writing a letter to the Treasury and the Department requesting that we carry over the surplus funds that we have in the 2012-18 financial year. From the 2014-15 going forward, we anticipate that we may have problems due to the budget constraints as what the National Treasury has requested. So we are currently in discussion with the department to try and see how we can really alleviate those problems that we'll have with the budget, because if the budget continues to be cut, we may not be able to exercise our mandate as per why we were established.
We've been in the most fortunate situation that in the last 2 years, because of the challenges, recruitment challenges, etc., we've had a surplus. We think by next year that would have gone away, so we would then start facing difficulties in terms of the budget. Our view is that members may recollect, and chairs will know, I forget when there was a 10% cut imposed. It was about 3 years ago. In our view at the time, if that 10% cut had not happened and our baseline had been going accordingly, then we wouldn't be going forward face problem. So we're not looking at a need for a very large increase going forward. But from 2014, we anticipate that if this year we've done all that we do, then we're likely to start getting budget problems, which would be in the region probably of 4 or 5 million, based on the previous that was made. But we'll have to see how we manage that accordingly. We may not be able to do something that we want to do. But it's our day, yes, so we don't want to spend it.
Thank you very much. Members would like to make any commentary, ask any questions. Yes. And then we'll Andrew Bia, followed by Dr. Bosman, and then Bukina Mabele. Yeah, in that order.
Thanks, Jefferson, thanks for the presentation. If they can elaborate more, what is the name with to those to the qualifications within which are not in line with the HEQF but still offered by university? And what would happen to those institutions whose progress report did not expect to address the HEQC's recommendation?
Thank you, Chair. Just two short questions for clarity. On the budget, the shortfall is quite big, about 8 million rand. What is the rollover fund? Is it going to supply another year? And what is the situation going to be going forward, the planning on the reduced income? Because I think that we are heading really in a direction that is going to be create a bigger shortfall than what we are in at the moment. And if we do not, if there's no contingency plan to rectify, then obviously the CHE will be in a fairly difficult position. Then maybe the last question to the department. It is surprising that the appointment of the board chairman is not finalized yet. I think it's we would just like maybe to get some information and reasons why it has not been done. You know that obviously we know when the termination of the board chairman is, and obviously the department should in advance make progress in getting the processes in place. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Jefferson. The first one is me. I'm interested in the two initiatives that we are looking forward to actually next year. Yeah, you did talk of the programs to be offered, the time, the time frame that is there, that we might not see happening now, but at least you promised that something will be done. But my question is, Jefferson, how far are you or are we the kinds of the programs that are going to be offered there? Yes, we are talking about them, but what is it that you know? You know, when are you investing in them being submitted to you? The reason why I ask Mr. President, we have had better experience in the country where we find institutions of other programs that are not accredited and so forth, then disadvantaging the students who have undergone through those programs. So I think that's what we need to get against on these new universities. So what advice can give so that we are confident that today come next year, those programs that will be offered there will be the programs that our students need to register on. And also on the issue of the cleaning up the program profiles from different institutions, can we be assured? I know the Honourable Dudu, I think she did ask on around that area, but really looking at the institutions that we have seen with the programs that are not clean, to what is it that you can tell us today? I'll make an example of investors in the end. There are so many others, but can you say something on those programs and how many are they now? What is it that you can say? On the new programs again, Chairperson, I'm very interested in the qualification of the FET College lecturers that we are all waiting for us to see those FET colleges performing in a better way. Is there any qualification of that sort that has gone through you? What is it that you can say about it? If you can just... Lastly, Chair, of which is not part of the presentation, but as CHE, I think they can have a word or a comment on it. the bold step that has been taken by some of our universities, like the KZN, of introducing the indigenous language as a compulsory program or subject for undergraduate students. I think most of us in the country are not that. That is what we need to see happening, because we want these languages to be promoted and our learners having access to. In any future, in the near future, can we see such things being adopted through all the institutions? What is the take of CG when it comes to that? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I would just like to ask, the CEO referred to that you're not out of the woods yet. You are turning the corner. Could you perhaps just elaborate more on some of the problems that you still have, excluding the fact the possibility of a financial shortfall, any other problems that you might have? And then I'm also interested to know, in terms of your advice to the minister, because you do a lot of research, you have quite a bit that you do and information that you can give, but, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the sense that maybe the minister doesn't use your expertise often enough, because it's only, I think, 5 times that you, in the past 2 years, that advice was given. What's your sense in terms of the status afforded the CHE in terms of where you are? Do you believe that you are a valued player within higher education? Thank you.
Chair, thanks. I just have got two areas or issues to raise. The first relates to the timelines. Doing quite a lot of things, venturing into this, into that, research on this, and so on. These timelines that we have got, be it on conferences, be it on whatever, with regard to standards, all these areas that you're dealing with, are the really stipulated timelines that we've got, that there is an expectation either on the part of the department to say by this time you should have concluded on this aspect and so on. Or you are at your own pace projecting as to think this you can conclude by this time or that time. The second, Chair, relates to, first let me say, to what extent is the universities, for instance, offering programs or qualifications that we have accredited, but which are not really recognized by statutory bodies within those particular fields. It does happen that people will conclude or complete a particular qualification, but professional bodies in that do not recognize that accredited kind of program. How right is that? Because at the end, whatever you're doing, you don't have necessarily some relationship with it. The problem will remain. And how do we see us closing that particular gap so that students or graduates are not necessarily frustrated when they had to enter the field of work? Thanks. Just to check, I to take a bite. I know Prof is coming. I don't want to steal something that he was going to relate to as well. But I know he's a professor, I can always pick on something else. You referred to what you're trying to observe or do some research around the effectiveness of administrators in universities. Surely that work is not concluded. But then, what is it that you can share with us now, because some of them, even as we are awaiting your outcome or product of that work, some of them, their term of office will end, there was vacated and so on, and decisions must be taken and so on. Is there anything, is there a particular trend that you can begin to share because otherwise we'll find that we, the judicial circle, there may be two now, there might have been three kind of administrators in the same institution. It may mean we need the third, the fourth, or fifth, and so on and so on. To curb that, are you beginning to see certain signs that you can share, or you want, you will prefer to conclude the exercise and then relate to something concrete? But we would like to begin to hear that if we were to come with other measures in the meantime, because we may not wait for the end of completion of that activity. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. On page 9 of your document, I'm just curious to, you did refer to this, that first place. The other thing is still going to be finished sometime this year. The restructuring of the duration of the undergraduate diploma and the diploma to address low throughput. I'm curious to know, to understand, what are you having in mind there? To add one more year, to change courses, to do what? In the last bullet on the same page about student governance, the last president says, aside from difficulties in collecting the relevant information, it has not been possible until recently to provide the junior researcher conducting the study with the necessary support in the absence of senior staff. As discussed above, due to cover's concern, it is intended that the project will now feed into the current state of education. I take it now, I'm on page 9, last paragraph. I take it now you do have the necessary staff to assist. And this has shifted from 2012, so it is part of this. What time frame are you now having? I'm trying to understand these figures. If I could say, I did finish my degree in 3 years, but one course that almost stopped me from doing that was accounting. Now, when I looked at your income, that's 64,232, and I added the expenditure figures, 550 and others, I got the same 46,232, and I ended up with the 46,021. I don't know where it came from, it just came into the picture, and I couldn't locate it. What is the basis of that? Even if you go to the next column, the figures for income are the same, 48,516. You add the expenditure figures, the same 48,516. You have put in the middle 48,558. I don't know where that 48,558 comes from. Again, using my layman, I would have thought the higher the income, the higher the interest. When you look at your income, interest income, when you had 46,323 income, your interest was 525,000. The following year, you are envisaging a higher income of 48,516, but the expected income is down to 250. And that is my payments now, just to get a better understanding. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Chair. Two questions. There is an indication in the presentation that institutions might be persuaded to work together with regard to student success. My question would be, how far would that take the institutions to merge or demerge? Lastly, on your budget, you have capital expenditure that is 550. I assume that is 550 rand. And then in 2014-15 it will be 900 rand. I just want to have a view in that type of capital expenditure. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. One question also relates to the budget. We see the figures there on the slide, but the CFO mentions 54 million. It may be their intention, but I don't know what the impact is going to be if we look at this budget and we conclude this meeting, this budget being this one, we are going to judge them against this one. If they are going to spend 54 million anyway, it's going to be an overspending. Maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I'm missing, shouldn't that 54 million that they are planning to spend, shouldn't it be reflected here? Maybe with a footnote to say, you know, subject to an understanding that they will get approval for what. Thanks.
To the department. I just wanted to say we do welcome as of verification of whether the program was
but in the show query, I assume that they're accredited. Will start the department just verify the accreditation of the chair of the chairperson of the council and other members?
Chosen the process has been initiated by the minister in the last term of last year. The minister should call four nominations during February, and we received nominations, and at this point in time the minister is considering the appointment of the chairperson from the nominations to
concern, I'd like to raise that. Should there be a structure?
Yeah.
In the existence of this council, whereby there would not be a chairperson and all that. I don't know what the laws is, haven't really checked that aspect. Normally, when a council's tenure is about to end, there will be a notice. Mm. 3 months prior to the expiration of the tenure, and so on and so forth, so there should not be a lapse. So, but I'd not want to argue on that because I haven't read your address yet this morning. I'll verify after departing from here whether we are on track on that aspect, because I would be worried if your processes may not be in line with the law. You find that you are walking at your own pace when the law says something else. That would be antithetical to reality, and I would be worried about it. Okay. I hope you answer later on if you want to clarify that further. I'm hoping that things are in order. Let's allow the officials then assist us with the answers to questions.
Thank you, Chair. What I'll do is I'll go through a whole lot. The CFO will focus on the technicalities on the budgets, which I think may have happened when the slides are being prepared, and then Professor Taylor will come in on the issues that you think appropriate. From her point of view. I would like, in relation to the budget, in relation to the last point, to say the budget we submit, when we submit our APP to the Minister for approval, has to reflect what the income that's being generated. We can't submit a budget that is a deficit budget. Okay. All we are saying is that in terms of when we look at the work we have and in hand, we think we need another plus minus 8 million grand. We know, because of the problems we've had in the last 2 years, particularly with our recruitment, some projects like the social work project could not happen last year because the professional council was doing something else, so we needed to wait until this year, that we have a surplus which we will at the end of May request the Treasury to roll over. The Treasury usually takes about 2 months or so before they finalize whether they're going to approve a surplus or not. I think we are reasonably confident, based on past experience, that because some of the work is ongoing and has already been there, that the Treasury, even if it doesn't approve all of it, will approve a reasonable part of it. If the Treasury says no, then we would have to look at our work plan accordingly. If the Treasury agrees to, let's say, whatever the surplus is, we're doing our financials at the moment, but let's say it's 8 million rand, if the Treasury agrees, then at some point we are expected to resubmit a budget to the Minister, indicating how we are going to use the surplus funds. So formally we're not allowed to submit a budget that doesn't reflect the actual income that we have. So we will do, if the Treasury by the end of August approves whatever we've asked for, then the Department will request a revised budget to be submitted, which will reflect the revised income and so forth. So that's how that process works. But maybe the CFO from the ACPK later on when we come back to it. In terms of the the accreditation process, and particularly the new unit, well, the cleaning up process. What we've gone through, as I said, with the first set of programs is institutions submitted all of the programs, we've gone through them, they've gone through whatever the process is. So there's some that need to be formally approved by the ATQC in terms of process. But once that process is complete, then the programs that should appear on the books of the institution should reflect what has been accredited. Now this particularly as it affects public institutions, because as you know, in the past, public institutions, their programs were deemed accredited at the time that the CAT was established, because it wasn't possible to go through the process. There may be programs in which students, well, not there may be, there will be programs in which students are currently registered, which the institutions will have to see them through, what you would, I suppose, call pipeline students. But once that process is complete, we will, the minister needs to, and we will advise the minister, once we've completed our category B thing, at what date that cut-off point is. We think it will be in the next 2 or 3 years, where no old program that's got pipelines can continue. So there is a process, and the minister will finally determine the date based on the advice we give. So we should be reasonably, that the problems that we've had in the past of programs appearing in institutions' books that did not go through proper processes, that in the next, through this process, should be no longer be an issue. In the case of the new institutions, the process is this. What we had indicated to the department, what the council had indicated to the minister, is that the CAT will do whatever is necessary to do in order to ensure that we don't stick to our normal timelines, which is it takes, as I said, up to 6 months, that we will create a special mechanism because of the national project this year. The discussions we've had, and there's a process that, as I said, my understanding, and I tend to be corrected, is that at the moment there are roughly 4 programs that are being planned for 2 new institutions to start in 2014. Those programs are being done in conjunction with existing institutions. So, for instance, in the case of the University in Mpumalanga, one of the programs is a program in agriculture. That is being facilitated by the University of KwaZulu-Natal. In the case of the Northern Cape, I'm just illustrating, I think there's a program in information technology. That is being facilitated by the Cape Peninsula University of Technology. So what's going to happen is, if you take, say, UKZN, UKZN, the program that's going to be offered in the new institution would essentially be the program of UKZN. So UKZN will be submitting on what we call ATQC online, because the thing is submitted online, will be submitting on behalf of the new institution what the program is going to be. And together with the project steering team, they will provide whatever information. Now there's obviously an issue, because this is a new institution. It doesn't have staff yet. Okay, the staff can only be appointed once it's properly promulgated, the council is established, and so forth. So in an interim period, UKZN will be offering certain services. When the ATQC assesses the program, it is aware that it's a new institution, that there's a process in progress. It will, as part of its process, put whatever conditions it normally puts on new programs. It would say, we accept this if the program is makes sense from a curriculum point of view, qualification point of view. We accept that at the moment you're going to be in the process of appointing staff. We anticipate by June next year you should have all these staff in place, whatever it is. Okay. So the process would not differ in a sense from what we would normally go through. It's complicated because of the timelines and so forth. So we're reasonably confident that what we've agreed with the project steering committee, there have been some delays, so all the programs haven't come through. As was planned, but we're working with them on a sort of regular communication. So as they come in, we will be able to ensure that they go through the normal process, and that we will be ready. I think the new institutions would have to be able to advertise in around September what its programs are going to be if it's going to enroll students in 2014. So because there are not a large number of programs, there are only four programs at the moment that have been identified. And because the programs are essentially coming from existing institutions, there shouldn't be a major problem in terms of the core of the program. The issues will be, and that, at any rate, even with, let's say, a new private institution, they can't employ staff until they know we're going to accredit the program. Because if we don't accredit the program, then if they've employed people, then they have a financial loss. So normally we will put a condition to say we're now accrediting it. By this date, we would like to know, we put in some preconditions on the staffing, on the infrastructure, and so forth. So we would do similarly with the new institutions, taking into account that it takes a while for them to get off the ground. In relation to the issue of progress reports, the CET doesn't have the authority. So even if we find in the case of a public institution that there's a problem with the certification process, the way they issue certificates, we identify the problem. We ask the institution, we need to rectify it. The institution gives us a report that this is what they're planning to do and so forth. So for instance, at the moment we have with two or three institutions, we have ongoing discussions about what they plan to do. I think the weakness, and you've read our documents before, the weakness that there has been in the general process is there hasn't been a link between the quality assurance process and the funding and planning process that the department undertakes. Because what you really require is if we say that this is a problem, the department has the authority from a funding point to say for the institution to account why it's not addressing whatever the problem is. So that's a discussion we're having with the department, how do we better align our processes. In relation to the issue of the Prof. Mayapura's issue, the FOIA, the proposal is do we need an additional year that is integrated differently from what currently happens. As you know, currently many institutions offer extended degree programs where they either so students do it over a longer period of time. So instead of completing a course in six months, they do it in 12 months and so forth. This is looking at, do you need a more fundamental rethinking of if you're going to extend the degree program, how do you do it? So if you're offering, say, engineering, instead of saying we do mathematics over a longer period of time, is there something else that you can do or the institution should be doing to address the particular gap in mathematics that the students face? So as part of this process, this report that's going to come out, we had established four curriculum task teams to say, go away and think about it in your discipline. Engineering was one. What is it, in order to address the gap the students come with, what is it that would need to be done in an engineering degree or diploma in order to address that gap, but which is not an extended program like we currently have. And they identified what are gaps, which I said are not necessarily an issue of just quality of schooling, but what fundamental core knowledge gaps that students come into that institutions assume that they have, which have not been covered in the school curriculum. So looking at a different way of structuring the curriculum, in the case of a three-year degree, over 3 years, a four-year degree, over 4 years. So the report addresses that problem and how to do that. I don't want to, because the report has not come out, and I presume it's also done quite a lot of work on looking at the cost implications. And I don't want to go into that because it will be headline tomorrow without the report having been released and so forth. So it's been fairly sensitive to what are the things that institutions are going to do, what are the cost implications of doing something like this, including the staffing implications and so forth. But that's the issue it's trying to address. In the case of let me take the broad area of, we do have, if you look at our the table at the end, the performance indicators table, we indicate the number of projects we're going to do. We don't necessarily specify, if we say that there were going to be three projects, this is student governance, this is this, because we want some flexibility. So when we say we are going to have a conference, it's conference in this financial year, up to March next year. If we don't have, there will then be a finding that we haven't met whatever we had planned to do. So we do have in our performance table the issue around the research projects that I've identified. we've got a long list simply because that directorate only came into place and we were trying to work out how this, what are the issues we need to do. But in our performance plan, we said we're going to do 2 projects, 3 projects, what the timelines are and so forth. Because we have to do that in terms of the issue you raised with the QCTO. So we have to indicate. And the AG looks at whether we've met the, whatever we said we were going to do and so forth. So we do have timelines and within the APP. The issue of the part of the student governance issue was of capacity. We didn't have senior staff. We've now got the people in place. So that project is going to get off the ground. The junior researchers in the background research and they're planning how to take it forward. On the administrative part, I actually haven't read it yet because we just received the background report that was completed. We think there'll be further work that needs to be done, but we'd be quite happy in a different context to share what we think are some of the key issues with the committee, even if the report is not released in its current form. If you want an engagement to draw out what are some of the things coming out while we continue doing further work. So I think we can certainly arrange, once we've had a chance to look at the details, because there were also interviews with people, I haven't read the transcripts and so forth, to see what are some of the challenges immediately that come up that we need to take. So we'll be fairly open to doing that. To go back to the program accreditation, professional bodies, when we accredit a program that is, let's say, medicine or engineering or pharmacy, there's usually a condition that's set. The condition which is that this program has to be approved and meet the requirements of the professional council, of statutory professional council. And we currently have, for instance, agreements, memorandum of agreements with the engineering council. We have one with the professional councils, and we look at it with others. But we usually would set a condition. So institutions should not be offering professional programs that are being offered in South Africa if they don't meet the requirements of the professional council. And if there are cases where we'd be concerned if somebody is offering something that doesn't lead to the student being able to get a license to practice because it's not recognized by the professional council. In terms of being out of the woods, I think we've got all our systems. There are certain things we're still introducing. We are putting a lot of our systems electronically. So our finance system, our salary system, we're just looking at introducing for our procurement system an electronic module. So in that sense, and also just making sure our staff are properly trained and so forth in managing all of these systems. So I think we've got the basics in place. And to make sure that it's a standard we've got, there's some things we're providing and are going to come and see. So in that sense, we're not happy. In terms of the advice, I think the minister's request for advice comes based on what are the issues on each set. So the fact. And it's an issue we have with the Auditor General. I raised it to that workshop. The AG sometimes comes and says, well, if you haven't given advice, it means you're not doing your job. And he says, well, the Minister haven't asked us for advice. So if you take the last year, in the previous year when we gave 5 pieces of advice, is because there were a whole lot of policy issues that he was dealing with on which he wanted advice on. And they were fairly substantial. It was the central application system, the unbundling of Limpopo, I'll come back to that. So I think it depends on what lies on the minister's plate at a particular time. Minister, in terms of the advice he receives, has responded, the minister has to respond in writing. The minister has responded in the case of the central application system to the unbundling of Medusa and what was the third one. So the minister has responded now in the last few months, starting sometime last year. I think that the elements of the advice the minister has accepted and the elements that he hasn't accepted. The minister doesn't have, in terms of the process, the minister is not obliged to accept all the advice that we give. I think as far as I understand, the minister is also meant to table whatever advice is given in Parliament or to this committee. his response to our advice rather than the advice itself. So I think it's an ongoing process. I mean, sometimes the problem that it creates for us, and I know I've discussed it with the chair in the past, is if when we give advice, until the point that the minister responds, we're not able to make that advice public. Okay. But people know the minister has asked for advice. I know on unbundling of Medusa, the chair said to me, well, we want to know. And it creates a difficult situation for us. We can't refuse the portfolio committee, but maybe that's something that happens then within closed doors or so. So that's part of the problem of the process, is we can't put, we now put the advice on our one, the minister has responded, we could have made our advice public. Because often the institutions also think we've given advice. And when the minister makes pronouncements, they think, well, the minister is saying A, B, and G, because that's the advice of what a council is. It may or may not be. So it does create a problem for us in the way people perceive the advice that we've given. Look, I think the broader issue of the council has had, because we've had a weak monitoring and evaluation in the last few years, I think we have to demonstrate that we're on top of the game in terms of monitoring the research that we do and so forth, in order for the minister or anybody else to recognize that the council should be taken seriously. And I think there has been a weakness in what we now identify. Similarly, in the way that the council has not been proactive. So the advice on agriculture that we gave recently is the first piece of advice that the council has given proactively based on the work that it does. So it's been efficient in the past to do something like that. So I think the onus is on us to, in a sense, be able to win the confidence not only of the minister but of the broader public that the CAT has a voice. And that's partly what we talk about in Paris, is to become, we should be the first port of call. We're not quite there yet. When somebody wants to know something about higher education, they should be coming to the CAT and not go to somebody else. So that's an ongoing, I think we're now ready to move into that space in a more concerted fashion. And then just finally, too, I'm talking a lot, and I'm sure Beverly, who talks equally a lot, I'm sure will have a lot to say about other matters. The course lecturers, the department has released a framework, which we were consulted on around the framework for what they think the teacher FET lecturer qualifications should be. I must confess, I'm not aware if we've received any accreditation applications for that qualification yet. I suspect it will be a little while, because it was only released recently, approved recently by the minister. So it will probably start coming later in the year or early in the new year. Finally, on the language issue, I did comment, if you saw in the media, my view is that it depends on the purpose of what this is. As I understand it, and when I looked at the information I have, is two things. One is to ensure that staff and students in the institution are able to communicate firstly amongst each other, that the students who graduate are able to interact in the broader society. So if you're becoming a doctor, you should be able to be working in KZN. You should be able to speak in isiZulu to your patients. It is at the level at which you can communicate with the patient, if not in the sort of deep technical sense of the medical knowledge that you have and so forth. And secondly, and this is a broader thing, it's not something new. For instance, there are a number of institutions that have over the last few years, I don't think they've publicized it adequately, have been developing glossaries of academic terms in African languages. So for the Rhodes University has a major project looking at IT, looking at law, the Durban University of Technology, Stellenbosch, UCT, there are a whole lot of projects going where people are taking what they call developing academic glossaries, which will then benefit students who are not just language English speakers, but also have to develop the language in a sense. So there's a lot of that going, which should be encouraged and supported, because it allows students to better engage especially if they're not first language English speakers. At Rhodes, my understanding in relation to law and pharmacy, where they have introduced on a voluntary basis courses is the course up for students, and they've proven very popular. Okay, so although it was voluntary, more and more students are wanting to do it because they recognize the importance of doing the course for their years. So my own view, it's not a council view, so I think it's that I don't think, I think there's a lot of hype about whether it would leave students not interested, because you, if you don't make a course compulsory, nobody wants to do it. People then treat it as, you know, often in health science faculties, students are asked to do courses in like in sociology or so, in order to give them a broader understanding of how health fits into a social context. If the course is not compulsory, even when it's compulsory, students don't take it as seriously as they should. So I don't, I mean, I'm less concerned about it being compulsory, given the purpose of the course. Okay? And it depends how the language is being taught. I think the problem, and this is a very personal view, so I think in the schools we should be teaching English and one other. My son does use Zulu. It's a very difficult language, because it's taught in a very conservative grammatical fashion. Okay? So it actually puts things off. Because what we're not doing is not trying to get them to understand. We don't necessarily want you to become a whatever in the language, but it's order to be able to engage with a broader society. And if in the process you learn it deeply, fine. But the way it's currently taught in the school, and I know from experience, is it's in a very rigid fashion.
Yeah.
Okay, so old style, how do you understand grammar, and so forth. I think we should do more of it. And I think in schools we should make it, you know, so that's a personal thing. I'm going to stop now and ask Beverly before the Bushy comes in on finance. I should just indicate Beverly is a member of council, so she'll be speaking in a capacity. But on some of these issues like the land, the council hasn't had the opportunity to discuss the recent council meetings in June and so forth. So in that sense, it's sometimes difficult when people speak that it shouldn't be that she's officially the answer to you.
Our CEO, you know, has said quite a bit, so what I want to do is just maybe offer you a few of my own kind of personal views, but also, you know, having been on the council now for a few years, and yeah, to see what it's worth. I think the best part is really, and I was asked yesterday to do a commentary on the introduction of an African language at the school level to teachers, sorry, to foundation learners, and so I hope I'm quoted correctly and it will appear in today's August. But basically, my view is that I think that one shouldn't be seeing the notion of language purely in a technical sense, but that the introduction of an African language is really the opening up of a whole new world to a category of learners that have up until now been excluded. And so it opens up a whole new cultural world which we need to have and to build as we start to move towards the building of an African nation. So I think that the UKZN initiative, I certainly think it's a pioneering initiative. I'm not sure though that one can translate it into other institutions for the simple reason that institutionals have what is called institutional autonomy. And so it really is a preserve of the institution's leader to make a decision as to whether they want to have it or not. I think that's really the issue. One of the key issues is around the autonomy and limited accountability that institutional leaders have in terms of being socially responsive in the country. So that's the point on the language. I think the second thing that I want to make, which is rather a broadly visioning point, and the visioning point is that but the higher education sector at the moment is one of four post-school sectors as we move towards the kind of expansion of our system. So higher ed would be one, further education another, adult education and then skills training. So we have to start to see ourselves as being part of this larger pool of building mechanisms for further expansion. And clearly, you know, there's challenges and opportunities. I think that there's a major opportunity, which brings me to the question of the extent to which institutions work together. Again, institutions work together only to the extent that they can benefit, because the institutions are operating in a market environment, so institutions are highly competitive. I think as our CEO pointed out, and this brings me to the role of the CHE, is that I think it's very important as a CHE that, you know, we continue to play a kind of coordinating function to get institutions to talk to each other, A, and B, to get the issues of quality out into the public without kind of very heavy steering, so that, you know, when UKVN goes into a Mpumalanga to such a program, that the CAD is quite clear and confident that that program is accredited, it's got high-level staff, etc. And by that, we can guarantee that it's going to be a fly-by-night. So I think that there is an important coordinating role for the CAD. And the last one is really around the, to what extent our university offerings accredited but not recognized by statutory bodies. I think that's a really legitimate question. I think one of the ways in which CAG tries to quality assure that is that your disciplines are really inside institutions and your statutory bodies have to have representation in your disciplines. So if you take, for example, psychology, it would be part of the Health Professions Council. Now the HPCSA, they would have their own minimum requirements, which the discipline of psychology would then bring in to the accreditation or quality assurance process of the CHE. So I think it's more like a bit of a spider's web, you know, when one is thinking in terms of accreditation and quality assurance, rather than a kind of linear, direct process. Just my last point, and I mean, it's really just my own personal view, and I'm at Gnosis. And I think that the issue of knowledge in our country is really the kind of what one can find as being, you know, one of the final bastions or frontiers of transformation. And it's the most hardest.
Particularly on professional bodies, there has been a big debate and we facilitated discussion, because one of the concerns of the academics at universities and the professional councils keep adding requirements that they want, which puts an additional burden on what should be taught in an institution. And there's a fine dividing line, similar to the dividing line, I suppose, between autonomy and accountability, is where, what is the right balance. So there is an issue, and there have been discussions, and in those quality assurance fora that we have, the academics and the professional bodies have been talking about. And the more requirements that the professional body puts onto what should go into the curriculum, it also impacts on addressing the issues about whether if a student is not adequately prepared, how much time is available in the curriculum to address their problems and so forth. And really what the institutions are saying, if I understand them correctly, is that they're not opposed. What they want to be able to do is to say to a professional counsel, when somebody leaves the institution, he or she should be fit enough to meet whatever requirements you have. We don't want you necessarily to tell us in a rigid sense they must have done A, B, and C to reflect that to the curriculum. So, but it's an ongoing discussion anyway.
Okay, thanks. In terms of the budget, I think as the CEO initially said, when we do the budget in, I think, around August, November, what we do, we look at how much the department is allocating to the PhD, and then based on that allocation, then we'll draft our budget accordingly. In the previous two financial years, we have spent less than what was allocated. For the previous financial year, we spent, I think, by around 6 million, which we've asked for a rollover from the department, and it was approved. After that approval, we increased our budget from last year to about 53 million, and based on 51 million. So based on that, then that's how we'll calculate our surplus at the end of the year. Based on the financials that we currently have for the 2012-13, our surplus is about 3 million. So if we take into account the 3 million that we understand in the current year, in the 2012-13 financial year, and the other for the 6 million. We basically, for the past 2 years, we have an understanding of 9 million. So what we will be requesting the department and treasurer is to roll over some of those funds to the current financial year, because most of the projects couldn't be undertaken in the previous financial year due to the capacity constraints that the CHE has. We anticipate that in the current year, since we have all the senior officials within the structure, then we have the project will start moving, rather than in last year where most of those posts were filled in the last quarter of 2012. With regard to the expenditure not testing, as we do agree, it's not supposed to be 46021, it's the 46232 and the 48516. With regard to the interest income, it has come down because currently we earn this much interest because of the surplus that we have. So when we start utilizing those surpluses, then we'll be earning less income on the amount that we have. What the department does, they transfer the money on a quarterly basis. So at the beginning of each quarter, we get the money, but then we look at what we have and then the surplus that we have. That's hence we've been earning the high interest that we have there. And with regard to the increase in the CAPEX, the increase from the 550 to the 900 is due to the replacement of the anticipated replacement of the office equipment and computers. That's basically based on what we currently have on our policies with regards to replacing certain goods. Hence, we have increased it because most of the goods will be reaching their useful lives around the 2014-15 financial year. And yes, I think that's all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes. I just want to share something about the advice to the minister. I thought these advisory bodies give advice when requested to do so by the minister, but I think there's also a provision that they can volunteer advice based on what is happening in the country, based on what they see, their professional experience and all those things. I'm not sure, possibly I'm talking about other advisory bodies, but I want to be sure, is Mr. Sof saying they can only give advice when they're asked to do so, because that would be very difficult for us to understand. I know that you're not necessarily talking about the issue of language and language policy, but look, for me this thing should have happened a long time ago, and I don't know what is it that we are debating. It should have happened a long time ago, and I also accept this thing that you should know. I mean, if I'm studying my mother tongue for academic purposes, and when I start another language for communication purposes, it can't be the same. It can't be the same. I think you need to do that. And I've always been saying, I don't know if how many of our universities have seen the model of Leuven University. Centrum for Living Talent, Center for Living Languages, and how they study languages. It's just excellent. You go in there, it's not your mother tongue. First chapter, how to introduce yourself. And by the end of the day, you can do that. The next lesson, how do you order in a restaurant? And then when you know that, they say, but how do you write it? It's very, very helpful. You don't learn the things that others, you know, I want to know the phonology and phonetics and what. You are taught a language in order to communicate and speak with people and to be able to write some things that you have, to be able to write them down. But I think there's just confusion. I mean, I went to university where people were taught, it was called Practice Afrikaans. It was not the same as Afrikaans 101. There was also practical English. People are doing 111 instead of 101. It never created a problem. What is it that we are talking about now? As if people are taught to be expert in isiZulu.
Thank you, sir. Just two questions. on the one on the nine that I refer to, I was attracted by the completion which was supposed 2012. And then with the new, we have another time frame that 2013-14. On the throughput rate and change in degrees and courses, I want to give my own practical experience now. When I did my junior certificate, it was called that. In my rural school, there was no mathematics. I did what was called general arithmetic. I passed it so well, I thought I could cross over to do mathematics. But when I got to high school, with my mathematics books, I was told, no nonsense, you can't do that. I was given soccer. I went up until I did my university, being told that I cannot do mathematics. I learned in Boston to do my master's in economics. They tell me you can't do master's in economics without mathematics. But they don't send me home. They give a course in mathematics. And there and then I crossed over and did my mathematics and I was able to do my degree. And that's how I check and you go to the States and then you go there not knowing a single word in English, coming from Korea, to do a postgraduate course. They don't send you home. They teach you how to do it, and you do it. I'm trying to say, check now, where are we in South Africa? Are we at any stage where we could say we can do that? Is that what CHD could provide?
And then granted disclosure, let me give the
current. Yeah, so the CHD can give advice on it, on what I indicated that it hasn't done. It hasn't used that in the past until very recently to provide advice on economies, as it did with the agricultural college issue. And we think we should be doing more of the key issues that the... I think the issue on language was a comment rather than I don't need to respond to. I think, Prof, yeah, the student governance thing we're now looking at in this coming year, 2013-14 financial year, focus on that. The other matter is part of the debate about how we integrate what the people are required. We haven't quite, the task team that we've been working on, that haven't quite looked at the kind of issue you're raising. And I'm not sure, Beverly may know more, whether institutions offer certain kinds of programs where you need to, because you don't have the background, and you just do the course. We're looking at it in a more holistic sense. This is what is the gap between people leaving school and coming into higher education, and the problem we need to address, which in one sense is bigger than the particular problem you identify.
Just general.
Crucial one. I think unofficially what happens is that the student has to do courses and that by itself extends their time. So you move from one faculty to another, you then do the courses in the other faculty. And you almost in a sense lose the courses in the one that you come from. So that's on the one level. On the postgraduate level, that kind of innovation, I think that, you know, the wrong is that universities are quite a conservative. And so, you know, we need to be thinking about these things more creatively. Okay. And I think it's really worth something we could feed into the CHE's research agenda.
I think that somewhat addresses the point raised by Prof. That we need to move forward and be contemporary in how we deal with education and not be archaic that if you don't... Your language is not the language of your university, you know. Yeah, go back, you are just a person who belongs to the jungle, right? This is a European thing. English, you see. So, it's the whole thing. But I think we need to say to the department that the issue of the FET qualification accreditation and the issue of accreditation of the University of Mpumalanga and Northern Cape. There are serious issues. In the last engagement I've had with Dr. Parker, we've always been told that no, of course, we're on track, these are complex issues. And I did say, for us at our level, nothing is so complex. Because we need such comprehensive technical detail to understand the extent to which we are prepared to begin to offer programs in those universities come 2014. We shouldn't be told in that stage that no, CHE has not approved the programs. They were submitted the day before the university began, and we think we'll use politics to advance the education. No. The reason why we're here as a performer is to be able to say we are ready in terms of the last 4 years, because building the courses is as good as building the physical structure. We've been building courses, and we are ready to submit, and we'll be able to determine the nature of the experts we need, and we'll be ready to appoint them by the date the minister promulgates the two universities in terms of. So we need to really highlight this point. This is a red flashlight. It must be sorted out, because we're here today, nothing is on the table of the Council on Higher Education, insofar as we know. And in the last 3 years, where have we been? Where was the department sleeping? That is the question, and I've always been saying to Dr. Parker, where are we on this point? Now, I think that the Council, I think, would appreciate to really energize the debate. Maybe that could be generated by your 20 years review on the state of education in South Africa. And as you said, you'll engage experts and then other specialized institutes. And as the portfolio committee, could generate the discourse by inviting the stakeholders, the minister, everybody. And then we generate a debate around that here in Parliament. I think that we're beginning to popularize those issues that require engagement. Who will investigate, I think, for the committee? There was the ability of inviting the minister in the next 2-3 weeks to really just brief us on a whole range of issues that relate to policy direction of the department. We know that there's a portfolio committee which cannot pronounce on policy matters. We do law. However, we do take interest to the path that the country is taking, and also would influence one another as to how we can shape the direction of our. And so I must take this opportunity to thank the Council for their presentation, and then hope that they will strive to achieve the targets that have been set in the APP and the meetings. Thank you.
Just a different point altogether, Chairperson. Chair, I would just want to inform the committee that one of our members is not well. She has been in the hospital for quite a long time. Now she has been discharged. Maybe on behalf of the committee, we can request our secretary to send a note to Session 12, but she has
not been. That will also be done accordingly. Thank you. There's no meeting next week, Wednesday, because there will be plenary in the morning. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Yeah. Let us take up tonight. If we see the constituents, and it is not going to be okay. And in the future, we will be able to get the money.
Yes, we will be able to get the money.